the Mark Stein Show. And now, here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. It is the Mark Stein Show. We are just departing Grand Cayman. In the fabulous crown colony of the Cayman Islands. We have all our cruisers with us. They all went ashore to launder their money, and they were told that that's all being handled through the Kiev branch now. So that's where they've been all day. And the theme of our shows today really is blokes in robes. The first group of blokes in robes are just guys in basic black. They're America's judges who preside over what is now the most brazenly politicized justice system anywhere in the Western world. And it is a very heavy judicial thumb that is being applied to this year's elections in the United States. And then, so after we get through with the blokes in basic black, Samantha Smith is going to join us. We're going to talk about one bloke in red ermine, who are cruisers. We have a lot of Americans here. They're the fellas who dig the guys in basic black. And then the others are Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders from various parts of the Commonwealth who are adjusting to the new reign of this one guy in red ermine. And so we will talk about both those things today. As I said, Samantha Smith will join us later. But first, we couldn't have a better guy to talk about the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt US justice system, because he has been on the receiving end of it. He was my old boss all over the planet at the Daily Telegraph in London, at the Chicago Sun-Times in America, at the National Post in Canada, at the Jerusalem Post, and at one time or another, various Australian papers. I'm proud to have been published by him all over the planet because he's one of the last guys on Earth who knows anything about newspapering, and he presided over what was the biggest newspaper empire on the planet until the US Department of Justice decided to destroy it. And one consequence of that is that all those publications are far worse now than they were when he ran them. He's had an absolutely incredible life. He was, I think it was honorary colonel of the Governor General's Foot Guards in Ottawa. You can look him up in the internet, and he's standing next to the Queen wearing some preposterous Gilbert and Sullivan type getup. And he likes dressing up, actually. I asked him whether he would be taking his, wearing his coronet at the coronation, and he said no, but he promised to wear it for me next time I went round to his pad for tea. So he's quite good at the old dressing up. He was ennobled by the Queen, and then his life was destroyed in an absolutely disgraceful and disgusting prosecution by the United States Attorney, and he wound up going to prison, where all the other inmates called him Lordy. He was held, he was regarded rather affectionately by them. So will you please welcome my old boss, the Right Honourable, the Lord Black of Cross Harbour, right here. And Conrad, I have to ask you, because when we go back to your trial, which was about a decade and a half back in Chicago now, you actually had Donald J. Trump on your witness list because you just sold him the old Chicago Sun-Times building. And And a dinner that you threw, attended by him, was one of the issues at the heart of the case. You and Donald Trump go back quite a long way.
Yes, about 25 years. Is this on? Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
The newspaper had been owned by department store owner Marshall Field. So it was a low-rise building, and I know there's some people from Chicago here. It was right by the Wrigley Tower, so right on the Chicago River, just before it goes into Lake Michigan. And it was a prime development site, and all my American directors said, hang on to your wallet, he's a scoundrel, he'll do the most frightful things. And so, you know, we watched it closely, but he came in. First of all, he produced a magnificent design, and Chicago is rightly proud of its architectural tradition with Frank Lloyd Wright and Mies van der Rohe and others. It was a much admired building, 98 stories, came in right on time, right on budget, full to the rafters with the most desirable occupants. And he was the best business partner I ever had. Well, and when the problems arose, he said... right from the start, he said publicly, this is nonsense, this man is being persecuted, and he volunteered to come and give evidence for me, and when I was a guest of the great American people, he came to visit me. So, yeah. You know, he's been a loyal friend.
Well, and actually when he pardoned you, which is three or four years back now, he actually called you on the telephone to tell you that you were being pardoned.
It is, maybe there are people here who are accustomed to this, but I was sitting at my desk and the phone started to ring, and the annunciator on the phone rolled out 2025, and then the rest were all zeros. And I thought, you know, that's the White House, you say. So I answered the phone, and I thought I'd be waiting for 10 minutes while he saw off a delegation from Liberia or something, but he came... He came right onto the phone, and I said, I hate to ask this, but is this for real, or are you an impersonator? So then, anyway, he set my mind at ease on that point. That wasn't just as it has been represented by somebody pardoning a friend of his. Alan Dershowitz acted for me, and he went all the way through the case with the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, and it was examined in great detail, and it was concluded by the White House Law Office that none of the four of us co-defendants, none of us should have been indicted, no charges should have been issued, and any guilty verdicts were unjust verdicts. In the American system... You have a pardon of mercy where you're not commenting on when the person was guilty or not. You just say enough is enough, let him go, or even if it's after the fact, let's put the record right. And the other is what is called a pardon of expungement, and that's what this was. So it was a vindication. Now at that point, they started with 17 counts, and we'd got them down to two, and of those, one was rejected by the trial judge and the other was ignored by the initial jurisdiction. It was an absolute smear job and just a destructive mission from the start.
Well, and you fought that I hate all this thing where there's multiple charges because it encourages jurors to do a split the baby routine.
Yeah.
And you have to it favors this idea where for the same so-called crime, there are 17 different indictments, and Donald Trump can certainly tell you all about this thing. But it's basically for the same so-called crime, and what it means is that the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt U.S. Department of Justice only has to be lucky once, and you have to be lucky all 17 times. And on the last thing, you fought that all the way to the Supreme Court.
Twice to the Supreme Court.
And
to the Supreme Court of Canada, too,
right.
A related issue, yeah.
And it was, but it was a unanimous decision. I think one judge was off that day, so it was 8-0.
The former Solicitor General, Kagan, recused, did not vote, quite rightly. But
right.
She'd been Solicitor General when the charges were laid. But the others were unanimous, and And in Canada, the issue was whether I had a right to sue for libel my original accusers. And that court was unanimous, 9-0, that I could. And I did, too, and I won.
Now, the thing about...
Thank you.
The thing about, as I said, this is like a decade and a half ago now, and I remember sitting in court. They basically put the American reporters, I think, on the left-hand side of the court as you walked in, and they put the rest of the world on the other side. And I remember sitting there with these reporters from London, from Canada, from Australia, and wherever, and we were all astonished at the things that were happening in this trial, and yet everything, and I think wrote a piece at the end of it calling for 6 or 7 things to be ended in US courts, and yet everything that I saw in your case, they're now currently doing all over the map to Donald J. Trump.
Yes. He has 75 or 80 million more supporters in the United States than I do. And he has more money than I do.
I thought you were going to say he has 75 to 80 times more cases, because he's actually fighting in, you know, in New York, in Georgia, in Colorado. He's being picked off all over the map.
But it's failed, hasn't it? I mean, every indictment, his popularity goes up, and it appears to be, I don't want to oversimplify or take liberties as a non-American, but it appears to me that the takeaway so far is that it is shaping up as a referendum between those who are so appalled at this perversion of the justice system and the use of it to try and destroy the leader of the opposition, that they are determined to elect the leader of the opposition no matter how much they have some reservations about him. And I think it will be a great moment in the history of American democracy when Trump wins for that reason.
Well, we kept hearing that there's a solid block of people who are never Trump. So if he's the nominee, they're going to stay home. And as you said, this business of indicting him twice a week seems to have changed the essence of the election, in that now it is about whether you want to go along with a crappy third world society that criminalizes the leader of the opposition and is doing its best to get him tossed in jail before election day, or whether you want to say, to hell with that, we're gonna elect Trump just so we can go back to being a normal America again.
Exactly, it's an absolute watershed moment for that reason, the Democrats, I mean, it's a great historic party. They've had great leaders, but recently, their entire program has been a smear job on Trump. It's just Trump hate. And the problem they have now is not only the tactical error of misjudging public response to these spurious indictments, let me put it this way. I'm sorry to be so syncopated. The Trump haters hate isn't there anymore. He was a person perceived, correctly or otherwise, and he did make it a bit easy for his critics, as a bumptious, boastful man, a rich man throwing his weight around, a kind of a caricature of the ugly American. And that Trump isn't there anymore. They don't have to walk his tweets back. He speaks sensibly. He speaks very, very tellingly in any of these interviews that he has, and he makes excellent points. And what the public sees now is a man that the establishment is trying to bury with a hideous abuse of the legal system, and an underdog fight, even though he's a billionaire and a former president, fighting for his position. And people like a courageous underdog, and that's what he is.
Yeah. And you're a great historian. You know the histories of every American president. You used a phrase to me on television a while back that they that that nobody had ever been tempted and imprudent enough to actually indict a president before. So what they've done here is unprecedented in historical terms.
This is right. The two guardrails, in my judgment, the ultimate guardrails on the American system were, on the one side, the courts will not tamper with the apparent result of a presidential election, no matter how dubious it is. They had that in 1876 with Hayes and Tilden. In 1960, President Eisenhower urged Mr. Nixon to contest the election, but Nixon declined to do it because he thought it would be bad for America in the Cold War. And in 2000, we all remember, Al Gore did litigate, but in effect, the courts tossed it and decided that they, I don't want to be cynical here, but the mm-hmm. Nixon and Reagan and Bush appointees to the court gave the election to Bush Jr. Now, they were probably right to do it. I'm not getting into that, but they were not going to tamper with the apparent result, even though it was, I believe, only 532 mm-hmm. votes in the state of Florida. And in the last election, there were 19 cases challenging the constitutionality of amendments to voting and vote counting rules, mainly in the swing states, and the judiciary at every level would not hear it, all the way up to the Supreme Court, which was the court of first instance for the case of the Attorney General of Texas against the swing states for failure in their constitutional obligation to manage a federal election honestly. And they wouldn't hear any of it. And the other guardrail is you don't bother an ex-president legally. I mean, Ford was ultimately praised for pardoning Nixon. And incidentally, 50 years after Watergate, there is still not one shred of probative evidence that Mr. Nixon himself committed a crime. Some of his people did, but he didn't. Mm. And Mr. Ford was right to do it. And he probably cost him the election. It was a brave thing to do. And I was glad to see that that hotbed of ludicrous political misshapening, the Kennedy Institute, gave the Profiles in Courage Award to Gerald Ford for doing that. Yeah. And now they've gone through that. They're indicting the ex-president, who happens to be the only ex-president since Grover Cleveland, who was the leading candidate to be the next president. And it is an utterly shameful and a dangerous thing to do.
Well, you called him the leader of the opposition a moment ago, which is a term more familiar
parliamentary.
In the Westminster system in Canada and Britain and so forth. It is a, people keep throwing the word around banana republic, and it's true in Senegal, I think they had a couple of months back, they had the leader of the opposition locked up, and then they found a court that released him. I don't really like the banana republic comparisons, because it's one thing when, you know, Senegal does something like that. It's quite another when it's the leader of the free world carrying on like this, isn't it?
Of course it is, and not only that. I mean, the American public and the American mythos is largely built on the Constitution, and obviously there's room for controversy about it, but since there's never in the history of the world been anything remotely like the rise of the United States in two long lifetimes, from the siege of Yorktown to the end of World War II, from 2.5 million colonists on the Atlantic shore to a country with half of the economic activity, half the GDP of the entire world, and a monopoly on nuclear weapons, an enormous prestige. The constitution that country had to guide it from that early beginning to such a tremendous height so quickly, less than a third of the time it took for the Roman Empire to get to a semi-comparable position against much less serious competitors. The Constitution must have a great deal to do with that, and it is a remarkable document, and it served the country well. But the problem is, if I may say it, I think you're kind of asking me, it's not being observed. I mean, these people are violating the Constitution. The Bill of Rights has been put to the shredder. As Trump himself has said, he was guaranteed an independent you know, an independent jury. They're poisoning the jury pool. Reasonable bail. You see this latest fiasco in New York on a civil case. He has to post $400 million just to appeal this nonsense. And no seizure of property without just compensation, due process, and prompt justice. None of this is happening. And the serious scholars, even people who won't vote for Trump, like Alan Dershowitz and Jonathan Turley, say that this case in New York is an absolute fraud. It shouldn't be received by any court in the country. And it has no chance of being ultimately confirmed.
Well, you say it has no chance of being ultimately confirmed, but now they've got the trial court conviction. They can just sit and delay, as you say, again.
I'm talking about Greg's case, about Stormy Daniels.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, though, that one too. But in all these things were present. The same, the system is biased here, yeah, in front or in favor of the prosecution in a way that is not really the case in Canada or Jamaica, the Bahamas, any of the places we've just been cruising through.
Look, Mark, what they do, because I saw it myself, it happened to me, is they say they want Mr. Smith, so they indict Mr. Smith, and as you say, they throw all the spaghetti at the wall. I mean, they accused me of racketeering, right, and money laundering and nonsense, you know, that I never in a million years would think of, and for which there's no evidence, obviously. And then they go around to the eight people closest to Mr. Smith in the activity objected to and say, look here, you know this man, you've known him for a long time, you must know something about this, so give us your evidence. And they say, well, that's nonsense, I've known him for many years, he's an honest man, there must be some mistake here. And then they say, well, all right, if that's your view, then there's a conspiracy to obstruct justice going on. You're part of it. We're going to indict you too. But if you manage to liberate yourself from your amnesia and come up with some useful evidence for us, we won't indict you. And furthermore, we will give you an absolute guarantee against a charge of perjury. Now, very few people can resist that kind of thing. With great regret, they roll over like poodles and say, well, now that you mention it, I do remember this and that. And they're like catechism classes. The prosecutors walk them through how much they can do, then they make the deal with them. And that's what you're facing. Your eight closest associates are frog-marched in to utter a bunch of lies under oath that they can't be prosecuted for as perjurers. And the jurors are stampeded. I mean, I ask you, all of you who are Americans, to keep this in mind. 98% of federal criminal cases get a guilty verdict, not completely, but partially at least. And 95% of those are without trial because of the impossibility of fighting the plea bargain system. Now, the corresponding numbers in Britain and Canada are 61% and 50%. And it's not because our prosecutors are incompetent. It's because the grand jury is not a farce. It's actually a hearing in front of a judge to see if the evidence is adequate. And the whole test of whether something is a triable case is much more rigorous. The defense speaks last, which is not the case in the U.S. The prosecution speaks last. And the criminal procedural rules are much fairer. And in general, in those respects, Britain and Canada have a better system. But you see, what astounds me, I'm really going off topic slightly, but there are 12% of the entire adult population of the United States have some kind of criminal conviction in their backgrounds. And I don't understand why this isn't an en bloc voting group with their families demanding not any free ride for criminals like these prosecutors George Soros has been parachuted into office or giving, but first-time nonviolent offenders aren't given a much better treatment in court and in sentencing.
Well, when I was in court in Chicago, the most pathetic figures in that building were your former directors on the board of your company, who were all... there was an ex-governor and an ex-ambassador and Madame Kravis, who was married to one of the wealthiest men in...
President of the Museum of Modern Art.
Yeah, president of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, one of the wealthiest men in America. And they're all suddenly up there at the behest of U.S. prosecutors, pretending to me the most stupid, gullible... That basically, their position is all these ambassadors, all these governors... The wife of one of the richest men in America, all just, oh, we're just gullible rubes who were just hoodwinked by this sinister Canadian. We had no idea what we were signing or what we were doing. The system is that they're, as you say, they're intimidated into joining the prosecution side. We see the same thing in Georgia, where the lady who's now in trouble for her lively sex life, where she can't remember how many continents she's been to with her paramour, that lady indicted, you know, 47 people and then rolled them up one by one, so they all cop a plea until eventually there's the president unsurrounded by all the people who were formerly with him. Exactly the same thing.
Yeah, but in the case of our three, the last charge that they had, the only one that stuck in the end because it was struck down by the Supreme Court, but then they sent it back to the lower court for, as Madam Justice Ginsburg, who wrote the decision for the court, said, the contemplation of the gravity of your errors, so they resurrected this count just to salvage something for themselves. And this was that I had improperly received $285,000, and yet it was in our public filings. It was approved by the independent directors. It had been published twice, filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission twice. What was wrong with it? Well, the answer is nothing was wrong with it. And these people, whom Mark just described, very sophisticated people in their way, said, well, we just missed that. We didn't see it. They agreed that interested party transactions is what you look at first, see what the directors and officers are doing. They agreed that they had that it was there. They agreed it was twice in the report. They agreed that they'd seen each of them 12 different drafts of the reports twice. So between them, they had sight of this at least 100 times, and none of them noticed it. No. And the prosecutors managed to sell this fairy tale.
No, I know. They all said, oh, I just skimmed the documents. They had this, and it's one of these lines that they'd been told to say. So every one of these ambassadors, governors said, oh, I just skimmed the documents. And I remarked that this was the most impressive synchronized skimming team I'd ever seen. And and it's weird, but it's weird to see the difference is the Supreme Court took your case, and as you mentioned, Madam Justice Ginsburg wrote the opinion because it was 8-0. It wasn't a political thing. Now we have a situation where it's the President of the United States seeking to get a decision from the Supreme Court on whether states are permitted to keep him off the ballot. We're three states into primary season, they've had their oral hearing, and they don't seem to be regarding this case with any urgency, Conrad.
Yeah, well, my view, perhaps I'm being an optimist, but has been all along that none of these cases would get to trial. They'll be overtaken by the election, and then there'll be no point to them, whatever the election result is. But the dilatory recourses available to the defense in American and Canadian and British procedure are very extensive. You can drag these things out for a long time if you want to. And it seems to me it's an act of desperation for Smith, the prosecutor, to their special prosecutor, to be asking a fast track from the Supreme Court. I mean, why should they give him one? And they told him to get lost. They were not going to give him one.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they've got, you see. The last-ditch defense after the spurious avalanche of legal charges is just trying to steal the election. And that is the one thing I happen to know from the... I don't want to put on the airs of intimacy with the ex-president. I'm not an intimate of his, but he does occasionally phone me, and that is the one thing that worries him. He's confident he can win. He's confident that he can deal with the court issues. And he thinks he'll win on the ballot stuffing effort. And he says they're certainly much, much better prepared to deal with now than they were. And a number of the states have reformed the procedures, you know, which were undertaken supposedly in COVID to facilitate a lot of voting that wouldn't happen otherwise. And so he thinks it'll be all right. But where you're sending out, as in the last election, 81 million ballots unsolicited to obsolete voters lists, and millions of ballots are being collected, completely unverifiable, put in drop boxes in the middle of the night after election day, no scrutinization process whatsoever, and 50,000 votes in three states would have flipped the result, you don't know who won.
Well, you say that as a Canadian, because by the standards of almost any other, I'm not just talking about the Western world, by the standards of an election in Botswana or Kenya, this is all very iffy. But the fact of the matter is, Trump's own attorney general assured everybody something like 2 days after the election that there hadn't been enough fraud to change the result. And I always say, you know, in other countries, that's not the standard.
In
Denmark, you say there hasn't been any fraud. In France, you say there hasn't been any fraud. Once you start saying there hasn't been enough fraud to change the result, you're actually somewhere on a continuum you can't reliably pinpoint where.
You're in Quebec in 1931.
That's right, but you notice it's only the Francophone province in Canada.
Right, that's right. Well, no, that is true, and... the implications of this are terribly serious. I mean, the United States does hold itself out as the leader of the democracies, and in practice it has been for 100 years. And it certainly holds itself out as a model that it hopes the world emulates in installing and maintaining democratic government. But it is not going to enjoy the credibility it has earned in its history up to recently in that way, if in fact the elections appear to be fraudulent, and if people's legal and civil rights are so vulnerable, even in the case of someone so wealthy and influential and with so many supporters as the former president. I mean, you can't suck and blow at the same time. You can't steal elections and profess to be the world's greatest democracy. So, you know, this is a terribly important election, I think. I mean, I speak as someone who is, despite the fact that not everybody has as many reasons to have grievances against the U.S. government as I do, but despite that, as someone who is ardently pro-American, but apart from that, recognizes that we, all of us who believe in Western civilization, of society, of laws, respecting human rights, a free market, freedom of expression, all of us must, in the first place, never forget or fail to be grateful for the fact that we owe to the United States the victory in the Cold War, and we must never forget that whatever reservations anyone might have about aspects of American life or American leading personalities, we need the United States to preserve our civilization, and we all have to hang together. Or as LBJ used to say, we'll all hang separately.
Well, let me ask you about that then. How do you think the civilization preserving is going under Joe Biden? Because you as I said, you know all the U.S. but you can do 25 minutes on Franklin Pierce or Chester Arthur or whoever. Where do you think? And that's I'm placing Joe Biden in the more modest ranks of the pantheon right there. Where do you think he fits in by comparison with his predecessors?
Well, I'm afraid not well. I always hope whoever the American president is does well. I'm no howling partisan. I don't have a vote in the U.S. And at times in my life, I've wished for both Democratic and Republican candidates to win. And so, you know, whoever it is, I want that person to do well. And I don't think he has done well. I think in the basic policy areas, he took a full employment, minimal inflation economy and did completely unnecessary damage to it. Practically every household in the United States today has less disposable income than it had then, three or four years ago. Mm. Second, he's gone cock-a-hoop on this green terror of his, and as a result, the U.S. is back to importing oil, and the reasonable, responsible exploitation of resources, and not just energy resources, has been severely hobbled, even though oil production has actually risen. But it's country's back to being an oil importer, he's tried to propagate this fantasy that the imminent demise of the world for reasons of climate change must take precedence over the welfare of the American public, trying to match its expenses to its income. This is just nonsense, and as well as bad politics, skyrocketing crime, and of course what we have on the southern border is not immigration as we know it. It's not people passing under the Statue of Liberty or at other points of entry and inscribing their names and moving to another country determined to become citizens and participants in that country and be part of the continued growth of America as Americans. It's more like the mass of Goths swarming into the Western Roman Empire in the 4th century because the Huns were pushing them from behind, and they had no notion of becoming Romans. They just wanted to get to a better life in the richer areas of Southern Europe. And, you know, we can, at a humane level, identify with poor, wretched people trying to get to a better life, but you can't run a country that way. And, you've got to regularize immigration, let in the immigrants you want, let in as many as is economically and sociologically feasible of desirable immigrants, but have a process and have a border. And if this goes on indefinitely, the pressures on the basic structures of this country, education and social services, and the level of obedience to the law, it's going to break down. I mean, ultimately, if they had their choice, at least 1 billion people would move into the U.S. And now, that will take a while by any standard. But the more this process goes on, the more dangerous it is. But I'm no xenophobe. I'm sure most of them are decent people. But you just can't take them in like this without recording it.
No, there's also a difference. You know, one of the features of America today is that the more lawlessness is accorded to certain groups, the more other law-abiding groups are sort of micro-regulated and harassed in every aspect of their life. So you know, as a Canadian, as I do, that while the southern border's wide open, on the northern border, I mean, I have there are families in New Hampshire who like to play the bagpipes and go and participate in bagpipe competitions in the Atlantic provinces of Canada, where they like that too. And then when they come back in the car and they're crossing back into America, the bagpipes get confiscated because bagpipes are apparently regulated by the United States Department of Fish and Wildlife. I don't know. I don't know which category the bagpipe comes into. So I often think, you know, if they just carpet bombed bagpipes all over Latin America, nobody would ever get in across the Rio Grande because they take bagpipes seriously. But that thing at the border has actually now moved inward. So we've seen in the last few years that certain groups can get away with, you know, burning Wendy's or burning down a police station or whatever. And then other groups on the other side of the spectrum over January the 6th get tossed in solitary for 2 years before even a scheduling hearing comes up for their trial.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes no sense. But we've got a junction of different events here, though. It seems to me that with the end of the Cold War, there was no real threat to the U.S. As the Soviet Union had been and Nazi Germany had been. And in this time of triumph, officially there was no triumphalism, but what we seemed to get was the tail end of the legacy of slavery. And I often say to American friends that I think that the United States gives itself insufficient credit for being the only society in history to go to the lengths that you have to take a formerly forcibly servile minority and not only emancipate it, but assist it in becoming absolutely equal. No other country has done that, you know. The process isn't finished yet, but it's very advanced, and it is immense credit to the American public that there's been general support for this. But as we get close to the completion of it, there was this, and I suppose it's natural in human affairs, there was this backlash of self-criticism. And the American mythos, based on some liberties with historical fact, like all countries engage in, but essentially that it was the land of the free. I mean, there are others that could say that, you know. But then came under attack by a sort of resentful element of society, feeling America was smug and over-successful, and then we got all this nonsense about how American independence was a slave promoting operation, just rubbish like this, and it got out of control, as these things do, and there will be a backlash, and the compass needle will go back to the center, and we'll get a triumph of good sense again. But you had that tied up with this Trump phenomenon, and so the people who felt threatened by Trump, because he did, after all, assault the bipartisan consensus in Washington. It's a bipartisan consensus, but it's a 95% Democratic city, and it moves steadily to the left, and look-alike Republicans to the Democrats, like McCain or the Bushes, or, you know, they get into high office at times, but really it's a process that is moving to the left, and Trump was the only prominent person in the country who saw that half the people didn't like how it was going, and he capitalized on that. And then the reaction, I mean, I do try and convince people like Norman Podhoretz, for example, that there is an element of optimism to be found in this, because the corrupt bipartisan establishment in Washington has responded so violently protecting their position. You can't say it's a degenerate society. I mean, they actually have, it takes a great deal of energy to indict Trump in this way and treat him in this appalling way and unify the press 95%, get 100% of the media saying there's absolutely nothing wrong with the 2020 election. That takes a great deal of energy. So they're not decadent. No. They're corrupt, but they're not decadent. So we get all this mixed up together. But I think if there's the correct, as I believe it to be, result in the next election, it'll all be a kind of, it'll be like a sort of deus ex machina. It'll suddenly come right, you see.
Well, that depends, does it not, on whether the Democrats and their friends are prepared to let a fair election be held?
I'd put it slightly differently. I think it depends on whether they can succeed in preventing it. And I think in this case they cannot. I think the public is much more aware of the problem. A number of the states have reformed the rules that made it possible in the last election. The Republicans have certainly raised their game in terms of combating it. And they have thousands of lawyers ready to attack everywhere. Hmm. So I don't think they're going to be able to do it. I think they'll try, but I don't think they'll succeed.
And is that just because the better Trump's numbers get, and at the moment, if you believe the polls, he's ahead in all the swing states, ever more comfortably. That makes it more difficult to steal unless you're going to be completely shameless about it.
Yeah, most of the polls, if you look, are conducted either by left-wing universities or left-wing media outlets, or the two put together. The only ones that I think are relatively reliable are Trafalgar and Rasmussen. But if you take the average of the polls in Real Clear Politics or whatever aggregator you're looking at, they show Trump from 2 to 5 points ahead, popular vote. Mm. Well, if you allow for the bias of most of the polls, that's really, you know, 8 or 9 points, you know, which is 14 million votes in an American election. And if you allow for the fact that the California and New York have approximately as many electoral votes as Texas, Ohio, and Florida, but the Democrats take the first two states by 5 to 6 million votes more than the Republicans take the last three states, that means that Trump is leading by 15 million votes outside those five states. They are not going to be able to stuff that many ballots.
Well, you're right. That is, when they suddenly close the polls at 10 p.m. and then start driving the ballot boxes around at 3 in the morning, they are going to have to check those boxes way quicker than they did in 2020, which is a good way to look at it, I guess. We'll see how that works out, but I do want... because now that President Trump has been through what you went through a decade and a half ago, I do hope we're going to get some serious reform of this stinkingly corrupt justice system. Do you think he's up for that?
I think he is, and I think he... Look, I don't want to get ahead of myself here, obviously. Anything can happen. But my own suspicion, by the way, is that Biden will not be the nominee in the end. But
okay, well, as you've said that, what does that mean? Kamala or someone else parachuted
in? No, I think something like Newsom with Michelle Obama for vice president, something like that.
All right.
I'm not saying that...
No shortage of nightmare scenarios here.
No. They'll fight to the end, you know. We mustn't underestimate them. But I feel a little embarrassed as a non-American taking such liberties, but you invited me into it, Mark. But the,
well, no, wait a minute. You've paid your dues. I visited you prison in Miami. I think what they did to you gives you the right to pass comment on the scene here.
I'll take advantage of that liberty and say that I may be wrong, but I think there will be many people who agree with me. I think Gavin Newsom is a caricature of a California beach boy greaseball who is responsible for making the greatest state in the country a failed state. To me, California is the state of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and it's a great state, but it's not like that now.
No, I first visited San Francisco when I was 18, and I was last there 3 or 4 years ago, and I will never set foot in that town again. It's too sad to witness,
it's
just
terrible.
Too sad. Thank you very much, Conrad Black. We will see you next time. Thank you.
Join us next time for another edition of The Mark Stein Show. The Mark Stein Show is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.